The data is the closest we can have to an original information source.
Hi everyone, welcome to a new episode of Data Stories. My name is Enrico Bertini and I'm a professor at NYU in New York City where I do research in data visualization.
And my name is Moritz Stefana and I'm an independent designer of data visualizations.
And together we talk about data visualization, analysis, and generally the role data plays in our lives.
And our podcast that we do together is listener supported, so there are no ads for mattresses or tools for building websites or something like this. So if you do like the show, please consider supporting us on Patreon. You can find our page on patreon.com/datastories.
Yes, and today we have another special guest. We are very happy to have a person finally able to talk about cognitive biases and their relationship with visualization and data analysis in general. And we have Evantia Dimara. Hi, Evantia. How are you?
Hi, Enrico and Moritz. Thank you very much for having me here.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, very welcome.
And I'm happy to join the Euro voice. I will be the Greek accent.
Yeah, here is another one. Yeah, very exotic as well. So, Evantia, can you briefly introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about your background, current position, your interests, and so on.
So, I just finished my PhD in visualization and decision making. And I started working in Paris as a postdoc in the HEI team of the Institute of Intelligent Systems and Robotics of Sorbonne. I came to Paris to do human-computer interaction. And actually, I would say that the way I see HEI is like problem solving. So for me, that was the deal, to find what is the problem that people have and they cannot do so far. So the way I see visualizations is that the data is the closest we can have to an original information source. Let's say the open data that we have about unemployment, about many, many, many different things. But as you know better than I do, these numbers are difficult to handle. We have statistics. Statistics don't tell us everything. So we need to know more things. And this is how visualizations come along in this project. So I wanted to see how, by visualizing all this information, we have more chances to make good, informed decisions that are based on reliable data. So for me, having reliable data that we understand, so who prevents us from making good decisions? Most of the times, I would say it's actually ourselves and the limitations of human judgment, which lead us, I guess, to the topic of today, the cognitive biases.
Yeah, I just wanted to say this sounds great, but there's a little problem there. And it's exactly this translation of, first of all, is data really objective? That's a good question
question
that we discussed many times already on the show. Like, how much is data really representing objective truth? Usually not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
the second part is, of course, even if we have really good data, let's say, like high quality data, the question is, do people still do the right thing with it when they see it? Yeah, and maybe this brings us to the topic of cognitive biases, among other things. So what are cognitive biases and what can we do with them?
So to explain what is a cognitive bias, I will start with an example. So let's take again the voting thing, like we want to vote. We have presidential elections, okay? So we have two candidates. We have Alice and Bob. Alice, let's say she has a very promising healthcare plan for the country. And we give it that 10 out of 10 score, a very good healthcare plan. But her policy for crime control is not well thought and organized. So let's give it a 5, okay? Bob, on the other hand, has a very strong policy against crime. We give it 10 out of 10. But when it comes to healthcare, his plan is rather weak. So we give it a 5. So if you assume now that health and safety are both important to you, this is not an easy answer, right? We have a trade-off. There is no optimal answer. So if I want now to manipulate your vote and make you vote Bob over Alice, this is what I'm going to do. I will do a marketing trick. I will add a third candidate in the race. Let's call it decoy. So the decoy candidate is very similar to Bob. He also gives, let's say, more emphasis to safety than health, but he's slightly worse than Bob. So let's give him 8 out of 10 for the safety and 5 in health. Now, for some reason, the addition of the decoy option, the probability for you to vote for Bob instead of Alice, will mysteriously increase because of this decoy option. And this is an example of a cognitive bias that is called the attraction effect or the decoy effect. So a cognitive bias is practically this, is a deviation of human judgment from a norm. So the norm in our case is a particular rationality principle that says that your choice between Bob and Liz should not depend on an irrelevant third option that in principle you should never want to choose that. Like it's an irrelevant item inferior from Bob. But this item can make you choose Bob over Alice. So this is considered as an irrational, to some extent, I mean, to some an irrational decision.
Mm-hmm. So you could say these are like systematic thinking mistakes we keep making all the time, or like certain traps we keep falling into, right?
There are controversial on this, what should be considered as norm, what is truly rationality, what's not. But most of the time it has to do with the deviation from a norm. A norm can be from decision making, can be a memory, a social norm, can be many, many things.
Mm.
Another example, for example, is like we have the availability bias. Again, in the same example of voting, if I ask you what is more likely to happen to you, a terrorist attack or a heart disease? Happy topic. Mm-hmm. So the probability of a terrorist attack, in fact, is, as you may know, is extremely small.
Mm.
Almost 7 million times more likely to die from a heart disease or cancer rather than a terrorist attack. However, if you're exposed to media, that they often support report incidents of terrorist attacks, and I guess not much report heart diseases because it's not a hot topic, I guess, this makes you feel that a terrorist attack is more likely to affect your life. So in this case, a candidate that is focusing on terrorist counteraction, for example, may be more appealing to you.
Isn't there something called like the vividness bias or something
That exactly.
When something is more vivid, then mm-hmm. it attracts a lot more.
There are many biases that have to do with familiarity. Yeah. That's the mere exposure effect.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the more you're exposed to something, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's another case of a bias.
Yeah, there are so many.
Yeah, there's this huge list at Wikipedia. We will link to it. List of cognitive bias. It's like thousands.
It's thousands.
Or hundreds, let's say. But as you scan them, you realize, wow, our brains really don't work that well. So we always think like, we are fairly rational, like plus minus, give or take. But then you realize, wow, there's so many like subtle ways we can be misled like very easily. Yeah.
Yeah, the confirmation bias that you already search information in the way that confirms what
that's
you already believe.
Yeah, it's a huge one.
Or like the clustering illusion that we see patterns and conspiracy theories and connections among random events that they don't exist. If we want to describe them in general, we can say that people usually fail to apply probability rules, they fail to apply logical rules, they appear overconfident, they rely too much on the first piece of information they see and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think a lot also has to do with some heuristics, like we try to, let's say, follow a certain path that is cheap in terms of thinking, and often it's okay-ish, but sometimes it's also totally wrong.
Exactly. Sometimes it's okay to do that. And sometimes this is a very effective strategy we have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not always to blame for.
Because engaging with the full information is much, much it takes much more effort, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing.
Can I mention two more favorites? So
yeah, go ahead.
Two more favorites from the list. And it's a great list. You have to read the whole list, or maybe read a couple each day. It's enough. You can make a calendar with it. But a really good one is rhyme as reason effect. Rhyming statements are perceived as more truthful. Famous example being used in the O.J. Simpson trial with the defense's use of the phrase, "If the gloves don't fit, then you must acquit." And this actually works. You know, you listen to it and you're like, that makes sense. That works. That works. It rhymes, right? And so immediately you're sort of biased to believe it. It's crazy. And the other really nice one is IKEA effect. The tendency for people to place a disproportionately high value on objects that they partially assembled themselves, such as furniture from IKEA, regardless of the quality of the end result. But that's when, if you're like coming back to visualizations, it's actually a problem in design. Like if you spend a lot of work building something, like it was so hard to get all these D3 scripts to work, and and finally it works, and then you say like, wow, that was a lot of work. Yeah, it's good work. And then you just that's the best
solution.
Better
to have paper prototypes, the less effort, the more
attached. So the more you invest into something, the more valuable you perceive it, even if the absolute value is not there. And all these, and there's so many of these mind traps and thinking fallacies we can fall into. It's crazy.
Yeah, Moritz, you just gave me an idea, because when I talk with my students and I tell them that they have to trash their prototypes, always so sad. So now I'm going to tell them, you're just a victim of the IKEA effect.
Exactly.
Or the loss of version also.
It was just cardboard and cheap stuff. So and it's hard. And I think it's, once you learn about confirmation bias, you see it everywhere. But also,
it's another bias.
It's something, if you're not aware of it, you don't see it. But generally with biases, I think it's like, if once you have a sense of them and understand a few of them, you start to see how often they occur. And you also learn about like how certain arguments are structured, and then you see where the trick is, basically, often with politicians, for instance, right? How they set up a certain framing or an anchoring just to put you in an emotional mindset that will actually have you misjudge something. And it's kind of crazy.
Even the order on the debate, if you have a debate, mm-hmm. and you see many politicians, you remember the first and the last, and you forget the ones in the middle. So they fight who is going to go first and who is going to go last in the shows.
Yeah. So a lot of rhetorics. And you also said marketing or advertisement, of course, use these tricks, right? But also the classical, like, skill of delivering a good speech or delivering a good persuading argument is, of course, has a lot to do with triggering these mind patterns. Can you train your brain to not be so bad? Like, can you sort of do the biases go away when you know about them? Is it a bit like monsters under the bed?
What is telling people about the bias, what the studies show is that just simply telling about people about the bias doesn't really work. Sometimes even doesn't work even immediately, but even after some time it fades away. Even when you put a warning message that says "don't be biased." Bias is like, it doesn't work. And amazingly, even when you have people who have domain knowledge on those things, like you have intelligent analysts, that they actually take decision about national security things in the United States, particularly was the study. They compare the intelligent analysts with college students based on how much their decision were biased. And the college students outperformed.
Oh my God.
They're more rational than the domain experts in finance. And so it's a very complex thing.
Yeah, I think one thing I remember from the classic book from Daniel Kahneman, what is called Thinking Fast and Slow.
Sure,
I think one thing that stayed with me is the idea that maybe one way to deal with some biases is just to have processes, right? So don't count on yourself. And there is this story of, I believe, he set up a process to evaluate soldiers in the Israeli army, right? Something like that. I hope I remember it right. I should. And he knows that himself and his team is biased in many different ways, right? So I think what they did was to just create a set of questions with scores and also guidelines on how to score things before seeing any candidate, right?
Yeah,
I found this kind of thing pretty inspiring, because how to distance yourself from the decisions that you're going to make in the future by using some kind of processes. I think it's an interesting idea.
Even the blinder view we do, I mean, it's mostly...
Yeah, but still, even a blind reviewer can have biases, right? It's like... That's tricky, So how does this all relate to data visualization, your mind, or also in your work?
So, I mean, okay, we understand that all these biases illustrate how human judgment can be distorted, right? So, okay, at the same time, visualizations are designed to rely on human judgment. So in the first phase, it seems reasonable that we should care about these limitations. However, I mean, I guess many people that hear us now and they work in visualizations or data analysis, they will say, okay, all these distortions of judgment may appear just because people are not very well educated, are not very intelligent, or more importantly, they haven't seen the data yet. And I mean, as we discussed, we expect the visualizations are closer to an objective knowledge because they access the original data. But I'm afraid that I will disappoint you here. Because we have to address many challenges before we be able to say that visualization can help on alleviating bias, or before we even know which biases can occur in which visualization activities. So the first challenge is that we already somehow said is that more knowledge does not guarantee unbiased judgment. So we say telling people about the bias doesn't really work. Even domain expertise that we saw doesn't always work. And they also did studies on people, like if they are intelligent or open-minded, and this didn't even seem to affect the cognitive biases. So since we say that simply knowledge cannot solve the biases, I guess there is no reason to be super confident that simply visualized data will also do. The second challenge is that the cognitive biases we discuss so far are not really tested with visualized data. So in order to verify the existence of all these biases, you will see many experiments like people, these are massively replicated in a lot of experiments. But if you read those studies, you will see that the people in these experiments are mostly see texts, oral instructions, everyday objects. Some of them are with data, some of them without data. And we don't really know what is going to happen if we expose people to visualized information. So current relations discusses those things, but we don't really have a lot of empirical evidence.
And we don't really know which biases apply when.
Yeah, exactly. There are many, as you said, 300.
It's literally hundreds. Yeah,
exactly.
So can you test, like, or are there like roles, or like, do you have to test individually, like which bias applies in which, for which chart type? Or, you know, I'm not even sure how to approach this at all.
I can tell you, for example, one example of my project, that we addressed a very particular bias in visualizations. So you remember the first example of a bias I gave you? I'm biased too. I started with my bias. The one with the elections and Bob and Alice, the attraction effect. So, for example, let's take only this bias now. This particular bias is only people have in previous studies have only seen numerical tables or commercial products like towels and pens. They haven't seen visualized data yet, okay? So what we did in this study was to see if this particular bias can affect the way people make decisions using a visualization diagram. So we ran a study asking people to choose gyms that are presented in a 2D scatter plot. It's the typical mathematical diagram with the two coordinates, the Cartesian coordinates. So we asked people to choose a gym according to two attributes, the cleanliness of the gym and the variety of the machines. So one gym was better in cleanliness and the other one was better in variety, as we saw before. So again, there is no optimal here. We have again a trade-off between those two attributes. So let's imagine now how this plot will look like, okay? The vertical axis was the cleanliness, and the horizontal axis, we have the variety. So in the very upper left corner, we have the clean gym, the one that is better in cleanliness. And down on the very right, we have the dot of the gym with a big variety. So what we did is that we also displayed some decoy gyms. So some particular people saw a decoy dot on cleanliness, which means that in the upper part, in the next to the clean gym, we put another gym slightly inferior, so slightly more down. Some other people saw the decoy on the variety. So they saw again the two dots I told you, and they saw a third decoy gym close to the variety, so down and a little bit on the left. So what we observe is that if we could indeed influence people's choices with these decoys in the scatterplot task, and people were choosing the clean gym more likely when they see the decoy on cleanliness, and again the variety gym when they were seeing the decoy on variety. But in this first study we have only three data points, and usually for visualizations we mostly care about larger data sets, right? So And actually, this particular bias and many other biases are like that is only defined and studied with three choices. And what I found actually very interesting is that when I read in psychology literature to see what's going on, I wanted to replicate something with more data. Where are the other options? So what the psychologists suggested is that the attraction effect may not generalize to more items because people will have to do a lot of pairwise comparisons. They will not do it immediately, so likely that the effect will eliminate, like, will go away. So I said, okay, but visualizations are really famous for doing these tasks really effectively, like pairwise comparisons and see many data at the same time and in an immediate way. So I said, okay, maybe the attraction effect eliminates for other things. What if accelerates for us? So we did that. This is what we actually observed, that when we extended the task for more data points, people were affected by those dense clusters of decoys. Mm. So the attractiveness of the optimal points were affected according to those, let's say, inferior clusters.
So people were relating the extremes to the closest cluster and said, like, oh yeah, this is like much better than all many these inferior, other 10 yeah. gyms in this area, right? And so
they were saying that if this point here dominates so many decoys, let's right. say so many inferior mm-hmm. things, must mm-hmm. be something
they
good.
Must be better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Something like that. And even mm-hmm. though they had no reason to, I mean, because we asked them people after we finished the study, what was your reasoning behind that? They didn't have a particular reasoning. So they didn't say, mm-hmm. I did this because I infer, yeah, they're going to be yeah. a trend. I mean, we expect that at least some people yeah. may think of something happening yeah. there. No, they say, no, I'm okay, I'm rational.
It has a lot to do, like when I teach, I often make this point that we don't really visualize numbers or individual data points, but we always visualize relationships between yeah, things. Yeah. And
exactly.
that this is what also people read. And so they read the relationship of a point to the axis or the frame or the other points, and but never exactly. directly the pure information, but always this relative judgment.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, super exactly. interesting. And so you were able to prove it exists. It's like a measurable effect, right? In scatterplots?
Yeah, but for me, you know, this study, I mean, okay, yeah, we observed a scatter attraction effect when we use scatterplots. But for me, the important message from this work was not only the attraction effect that, okay, it applies to scatterplots. For me was this, that the people who did this study, the participants understood the data, understood the scatterplot. They didn't do any mistake. They were choosing one of the two superior options, right? So in the way we see these right now, the way we evaluate visualizations, we treat data somehow like a holy grail, right? So we believe that once people understand the data, and these people understood the data, immediately draw a right conclusion. So we focus on the limitations of human vision and the reasoning.
Just readability, basically, but that doesn't guarantee.
I remember your talk actually with Jessica Holman about this topic perception is vision perception, of course, is super critical, but what happened after?
I mean, if I turn this around, if I'm a bit like playing devil's advocate, maybe.
Yeah, do that.
So doesn't this mean if we turn it around that nothing matters and that we can draw the data any way we want?
Yeah.
That's a common theme here, right? So we dig this deep hole and then we ask ourselves, should we trash everything?
We should see it as a challenge for a designer.
No, but what I'm trying to say is, doesn't it mean we can be much more loose in how we display our data if the basic message is right?
Well, the thing is that it's a matter of framing. So since it seems that framing can affect us so much, like the way we frame a problem can affect us so much.
Right.
Then that can also turn us in our sleeve, because then we can reframe the problem and manipulate the monkeys.
And then precision is good again. If like once you have established the right frame and the right way of thinking about something, then precision is good again, right?
I mean, as a designer, you can change the framing. So if a problem is framed in a way that confuses people and make them certain in a certain way, if you change this design and you change the framing, maybe you can make them more objective.
But I think it's a good case to think about, maybe precision is not always everything, and maybe even you can leave out data, or you should leave out data if you include it, people will sort of read that part of the graph way too much, or overinterpret it, or establish these wrong rankings or relationship effects. So I think that's a very interesting takeaway here, that the whole point is what people take away from reading the graph, not if you have depicted every single data point, right?
Exactly. That's a very good point, actually. Yeah. And it particularly applies to the attraction effect, because the truth is that if you remove the decoys, you don't have attraction effect. Okay, yeah. I don't suggest that.
Less
this is,
data, better judgment. It's kind of interesting. Yeah, crazy.
It's kind of a case, yeah. A very interesting point, actually.
Yeah. And so this attraction effect could be fixed with a displaying working on the distribution of the data points you show, probably? Or are there other strategies how you could fix it?
I think we can explore, because I'm working a bit on a project like that, I don't have yet enough evidence to say for sure. But it seems that, the way you interact with the data, as you say, can affect the way you see those decoys. So, for example, if you treat them in a way, different design variations. So even if you display those decoys, but you somehow hide them or de-highlight them or make people interact with them in another pattern, maybe likely people will see them as less important, because the problem is here that for some reason you consider the decoys as important and you shouldn't. So I think this is, particularly for the attraction effect, I think this is could be an approach. But, we have so many biases that, But I think that because, they say that one good reason why biases occur is the information overload. This is what makes us need to have a shortcut, need to rely on the most pronounced part of the information. Uh-huh. So if we do what you say, we try to find a way to manage this information. So instead of displaying everything, to find a way to help people to manage the overload and clean the decision space and organize it better. This, I think, can be a very promising thing to do.
Would you also say user testing could be a good way in general, to find out if your visualization method is very prone to specific biases?
Thank you very much for this question.
Was not prepared.
It was not prepared. That's why I thank you so generously. Because actually this was my thought. Somehow, you remember this list that you saw in Wikipedia, right? It was so big. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying to myself, I would like somehow to make people test those things in visualizations, right? So this is my second project, actually. I wanted to encourage people to do that, like to see which of those biases can affect and then try to think of design variation. That was my sneaky plan. So what we did in this project is that I wanted to take those biases and do a taxonomy based on tasks. And then based on this task to encourage somehow a designer to try to test them in visualization. Mm-hmm. So let's say, imagine, for example, you are a visualization designer and you work in a company that makes tools for choice support, okay? Okay, you want to present your data very well. You are aware that people make decisions can be subject to biases. And once you go to the Wikipedia page and you see all these hundreds of biases, you're somehow, okay, what do I do now? I mean, how do I'm going to handle all this? So the taxonomies we see right now on biases rely a lot on explanatory theories. So we have, let's say, we divide biases according to what we think that people think when they do the mistake. Mm-hmm. So let's say we say that there are false memory associations, it's a formation overload. But all these explanations, I mean, what should a designer do about that? It's not easy to grasp and test those concepts. So the idea behind this project was to base them on tasks. Let's say one of the tasks in this taxonomy is the decision task. So some biases involve experimental tasks that people have to make a decision. And then I hope that this can be a way of thinking of them instead of trying to understand all this complexity around psychology theories that it's hard for us to grasp. Maybe we can think of them just as this is a task, this is a norm, this is a deviation, we test it, we put some imagination to think it of in a visualization context, and we move on. I mean, we do a test.
Yeah, so basically you are creating a sort of translation of the existing taxonomies for people who work in visualization to better understand how existing cognitive biases may translate in situations where people are using visualization to make decisions.
Yeah,
right?
That could be super
try
helpful.
To avoid the psychology. I love it personally. I have this thing that I love to read about psychology stuff, but I guess that everybody wants to dive into this.
And you need some pragmatic way of approaching it because it's such an overwhelming, multitude of potential biases out there. So some checklist or some like decision tree approach could be super helpful. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, I was just saying that I think another aspect that I find really interesting in your work is that you seem to focus a lot on decision making, and this made me think that surprisingly, there is not a lot of work on how visualization works when it's used for the specific purpose of making decisions. But we know that it can be really powerful.
Which sounds like
a
very fundamental use of data.
Yeah, right, right. Yes, that's always amazes me, right? It's like, why don't we actually, because we always talk about the use of visualization for presentation, the use of visualization in data science, the use of visualization in blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Right?
But
there are a thousand different things.
For using visualizations for getting famous on Twitter, so that's something.
Exactly, right?
I mean, you need to start somewhere.
You know, what you say now is a painful story of my life because, you know, my PhD started with a title that involved group decision making and combination of visualization and automated approach. That was my first title. My thought was this, that in visualization, of course, the decision making is super addressed so far, so I need to go one step up, right? That was my initial thought
Then
I started, okay, it's always in the introduction of every good book in visualization, so you always say we do decision making, yes we assist decision, okay, but then when I dive into the experimental, the empirical approaches, what we really test, I didn't find almost any decision-making task inside.
Yeah, nobody's testing for that.
I saw many, I mean, hypothesis testing and many important things, but didn't see any people choosing stuff. That was one thing. So then I narrowed down the PhD in the decision-making information visualization. not. So that was a
perfect issue. Yeah, I think we have to wrap up soon. I think just
Shall we listen to the bias song? We need to listen to the bias.
Yeah, we should listen to the bias song before we conclude.
Oh, yeah.
I just wanted to ask you, I think, so for people who are listening, what are your suggestions in terms of, I would say a couple of things. One is, if they want to know more about cognitive biases and how they may influence the work of people who are working in visualization or with data in general, and and what to do in practice, right? So say I am a visualization designer and I listen to this episode, so what should I do next? Right.
So actually I would say that first of all, what I believe should be the view when it comes to cognitive biases in the way I'm thinking of it, exactly. So sometimes, you know, the research is not a linear process always, right? So sometimes what we do is that we have an idea about a cool design that we really like, and once we have everything done, we want to find a problem. So we say, okay, now what do I do with it? What people cannot do, or what tasks should people do? So one way of seeing those biases and those huge lists that you see in Wikipedia is to see them as a list of open research small problems that they have a way to measure them. They have a way to there are well identified problems. So if you're stuck and you don't know what would be your next big problem that you can address, you can take a cheat sheet, which is the cognitive bias list, and say, okay, these are the things that people cannot do. They cannot escape from their initial hypothesis. They cannot. They are affected by an order. For example, I give you an example of this. The simplest I can think of. We know from biases that order matters, right? What comes first? What comes next? There are some particular contexts that the order matters and affects the way you decide. Mm-hmm. So if I was a visualization designer, I would say, okay, what if I put a circular layout, let's say, that the order is not particularly perceived in a certain way? Could this de-bias those people, or I cause other effects or something? So for me, this is a way to see the whole. These are well-identified problems.
It's just like be aware that some things, very superficial things, might lead people in a certain direction and just assume that all the time. Yeah, that helps.
That's true.
Cool. Yeah. I think we should wrap it up. Fantastic topic. It's one of one of the most fascinating psychological topics, I think.
So. I agree.
I hope we were able to excite a few people for it. And if not, there's a song coming up that summarizes everything. So you can learn anything about
the song
biases in 3 minutes. Yeah, it's really good. And so at least this one should entertain you. Thanks so much for joining us, Evantia.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It was great. I had a very good time with you.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm biased because I knew it all along. Hindsight bias, I knew it all along. I'm biased because I put you in a category which you may or may not belong. Representativeness bias, don't stereotype this song. I'm biased because of a small detail that throws off the big picture of a thing. Anchoring bias, see the forest for the trees. I'm biased toward the first example that comes to mind. Availability bias, to the first thing that comes to mind. Oh, bias, don't let bias see your mind. Bias, don't try this, it'll influence your thinking and memories. Don't mess with these, but you're guilty of distorted thinking. Cognitive bias, your mind becomes blinded. Decisions and problems, you've been forced to solve them wrongly. I'm biased because I'll only listen to what I agree with. Confirmation. confirmation bias. You never mind if you are this. I'm biased because I take credit for success, but no blame for failure. Self-serving bias, my success and your failure. I'm biased when I remember things the way I would have expected them to be. Expectancy bias, false memories are shaped by these. I'm biased because I think my opinion now was my opinion then. Self-consistency bias, but you felt different way back when. Oh, bias, don't let bias in your mind. Bias, don't try this, it'll influence your thinking and memories. Don't mess with these, you're guilty of distorted thinking. Cognitive bias, man becomes blinded. Decisions and problems you've been forced to solve them wrong.
Hey folks, thanks for listening to Data Stories again. Before you leave, a few last notes. This show is now completely crowdfunded, so you can support us by going on Patreon. That's patreon.com/datastories. And if you can spend a couple of minutes rating us on iTunes, that would be extremely helpful for the show.
And here's also some information on the many ways you can get news directly from us. We're, of course, on Twitter at twitter.com/datastories. We have a Facebook page at facebook.com/datastoriespodcast, all in one word. And we also have a Slack channel where you can chat with us directly. And to sign up, you can go to our homepage, datastory.es, and there is a button at the bottom of the page.
And we also have an email newsletter. So if you want to get news directly into your inbox and be notified whenever we publish an episode, you can go to our homepage, datastory.es, and look for the link you find at the bottom in the footer.
So one last thing we want to tell you is that we love to get in touch with our listeners, especially if you want to suggest a way to improve the show, or amazing people you want us to invite, or even projects you want us to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. And don't hesitate to get in touch with us. It's always a great thing to hear from you. So see you next time, and thanks for listening to Data Stories.